Okay, good afternoon and welcome. This afternoon's session on 10 extraordinary things to achieve with integration services. This has been a pet presentation of mine for some time, and I've just had the opportunity to upgrade it to the new feature set in Integration Services 2012. A little about myself. I am Australian. I've been living in the US for the past 4 years, so my accent is a little confused. But I have worked in the SQL Server BI space for now over, 12 years. Starting with the 2000 release of the product, specializing mainly in analysis services, but find that integration services becomes a necessary in preparing the data in order to produce the data model on top of it. I've been a trainer for the past 10 years. I specialize in producing content, hands-on labs, still active as a trainer, and recently I was here for the BI Academy last week. Who was here for that? So a good number, a good dozen or so of you. Welcome back. And welcome to the rest of you to share with me what I think are some extraordinary features that ship with the product. So be aware that this session has been developed to inspire you with the potential that can be achieved with SQL Server 2012 integration services. It has not been designed as an introduction, so there is some expectation that you know how to assemble a package, that you know what control flow is, that you know what data flow is. We'll be exploring beyond the basics in this session. Attendees with no prior experience, welcome to stick around because you'll learn about what you can do and it will perhaps make you more eager to become skilled in this product. Here's the session outline. 10 things. It was actually a challenge to come up with what made the cut. There were so many extraordinary things I think you can achieve with this product, but I've narrowed it down to these 10. I'll actually welcome your feedback during the evaluation process. If you've got any comments about what should have made it, what didn't, in fact, what your favorite might be something great to hear about as well. And then I'll revamp the deck for future presentations. So it's really just a matter of working through this session outline, starting with a reasonably straightforward one, and that is the ability to export or import binary data, typically photographic information, JPEG, for example. So we have the export column and the import column. So in the data flow, the export column can be used to export data, binary data that you've retrieved from a source, and it's a row transformation. So each row passing into it will produce a file on the file system consisting of that binary data. Why I think this is more relevant today is that if you're familiar with the tabular data modeling approaches with PowerPivot or the new tabular project, one of the optimizations to support PowerView is to provide images to PowerView. And while you might have that binary data inside your relational data source, it's not necessarily a good place to keep it for the data modeler because replicating that data in a data model could be expensive. All right, the preferred practice would be, if you have large volumes or large sizes of files, would be that you store them externally, expose them through a virtual directory on a web server, produce a calculated column with a fully qualified URL to that image. And so here's an approach that you can use to get those files created. So I have a demonstration for each of these. Welcome to my project. I'll just point out this project is to populate a data warehouse. It has some extra tasks like exporting photographs. So I have a package dedicated for this. And I already have produced a data flow that sources all of the product information that I have in terms of the unique identifier, the primary key, and the binary data, which is the photograph itself. I have a parameter, and that's an extraordinary thing in its own right. New in 2012, didn't make the cut in the top 10. But the parameter here is saying that the folder that they should be sent to as files will be the product photos on the D drive. Remember this, because we're going to come back with another feature and explore this. In the data flow, then, I have a derived column that produces this calculation, a new column named file path that pretty much concatenates the value of that parameter to a backslash to the id.jpg. And then it's a simple matter of introducing from the other transformations an export column. And to configure this, where's the data? So it's in my photo column coming from the source. What will be the file path, the new derived column, and I'm going to allow the truncate. So if it exists as a file already, overwrite it, and then I'll go ahead and execute. And as simple as that, I don't know if developers have battled with this one before, but getting binary data out of a table could be as straightforward as this type of design in a package. The reverse is achieved through the import column. Okay, time doesn't permit. I would love to show you, but in a 60-minute session, that made the cut today. So if you have files on the file system and you want that image data inside the table, the import column will do the reverse for you. Number two, and by the way, these are not in any specific order, although they just help with the way that the demonstration unfolds. When it comes to deduplicating data, there are numerous components in the data flow that can assist you. I actually have a prize for someone that can first tell me, and this is a really cool thing, ArcTouch mouse. Which one of these five actually won't deduplicate your data? Yeah, who said that first? I thought I heard it in the back of the room. Did this gentleman say it first? All right. So if you attended my session this morning, you will learn that the DQS cleansing is great for correction of data but doesn't support the matching rules that you might have in a knowledge base. So we're actually going to cross that one off. I thought I'd include it because it's an obvious oversight that you would think that you could use this within the data flow. What that leaves is these four. The lookup, oddly enough, allows you to redirect or remove rows based on an exact lookup. Okay, I already have that in this source of data over here, so just remove it. By using the no match, if the match doesn't succeed in the lookup, you can redirect it and consume that output. These are what don't match. We don't have it. The fuzzy lookup does it on an approximate match, whereas the lookup is an exact match. So the fuzzy uses approximate approaches. The fuzzy grouping will remove, or not remove actually, will identify duplicates based on approximate matching. Now the difference between fuzzy lookup is it's comparing it to an external set of data. The fuzzy grouping is comparing it within its own set of data. And then finally, and I thought that I might trick some people by thinking that sort is the odd one out here. Sort has this little checkbox in the bottom left-hand corner of the UI that says remove duplicates based on sort keys. So it's a way of removing duplicates based on what you're sorting. All right, so let's take a look at this in demonstration. So I have this objective to import new customers into the database. And so let's ignore the fact that I have this going on. I'm going to come back and talk about this in another demonstration. We'll focus immediately on the data flow, and I'll point out that I have this Excel workbook that contains 10 new customers, and I need to get them into my customer table. But my concern is that I have these suspicions that I already have them. Okay. Or some of them anyway, and how can I, within the data flow, identify and remove them so that I only load the genuinely new customers that we don't already have? So the first thing that I do is I do a lookup to say, well, if we have the email address already registered in the customer table, then we already have this customer. It's the same email address. And so a lookup can be configured to do this. I point out the connection is to my source system. I do a lookup against all of the email addresses that I currently have. I configure the input email address to match on the lookup email address, and importantly, I want to redirect rows that don't match to that, and that's the output that I'm going to take further. So those that don't match will then pass into this sort. And what this sort is doing is sorting all of the new customers that I'm loading by email address, see in the bottom left corner, remove rows with a duplicate sort value. Which ones is it going to remove? It's actually quite arbitrary. We're going to end up with one of them. If it's important for you to know, then you'll have to use some other configuration. The output of this will then move forward to remove, again, exact matches within my new set based on first name, last name, and birth date. I'm going to make the assumption that if I have the name and the same birth date within the same set, it's just a duplicate. Just give me one of them. Then the output of it goes to the fuzzy grouping. This time I'm going to look up on name and address where it finds approximate matches. So see the way that I've checked that I want first name, last name, and the address attributes to be fuzzy looked up. You'll see here on the advanced tab that what it's going to output will be a score that if it thinks that it's a duplicate, how close is it to one of the existing rows within that set? And I'll show you the values that it comes up with shortly. But as I mentioned on the slide, the fuzzy components will help identify. They won't actually remove for you. They'll provide those extra statistics that you can then use downstream, as I do here in a conditional split, to say, if the score is less than one, then it's a duplicate. And I'm going to go ahead and then consume the no duplicates that are output from this transformation. I then pass that into another lookup. So now I'm at the point where, do we already have against the source system the first name, last name, or birth date? So I perform a lookup against the exact matches of what we already have, and then I redirect the ones that don't match. And then finally, for what's left over, let's use a fuzzy lookup in case we still have it in the source system, but it's not an exact match. And so here, using a fuzzy lookup, I'm matching the columns in the source. Well, first of all, notice that I'm not passing through the statistics that were generated by the fuzzy grouping. They're no longer relevant to the data flow. But I'm passing through the first name, last name, and the addresses. And then I'm asking it to look up the most closest matching customer ID that it can find. Now, in addition to returning that customer ID, it will return a statistic that I can then use, and that will be how similar. And anything that I'm saying is greater than 90% similar, we already have. And therefore, I'm only interested in consuming the no match, which is less than 90%. Okay, there's a lot that's going on there, but what I'd like to point out is that you have flexibility and a rich set of components that will allow you to help detect duplicates, either within the same set that's passing through the data flow or against an external set. I'm not going to run the package just yet. There's a little more to be done, and then I can execute. Number three, implementing custom logic with scripts. So custom logic can be implemented with your favorite .NET programming language, whether it's VB.NET or C#. You have Visual Studio tools for applications that will allow you to write your code, debug it. There's color coding, there's IntelliSense, there's help. Notably, in the latest release of SQL Server 2012, there's debugging support in the script component in the data flow. We hadn't had that before. So the script task allows script or custom logic inside the control flow, whereas the script component, interestingly, can be configured to be either a source, a transformation, or a destination, allows you to implement custom logic there. So in demonstration, what I overlooked before was that we have in the database all of these customers. There are some, what do we have? That's actually the wrong script. There are presently 18,484 rows in this query. That's all my customers in the sales database. Of interest here is that the customer ID column itself, see how it uses AW and then some numeric sequence? So in order to generate, for the new customers that I'm about to insert into here, I want to generate the next sequence number. The way that I've designed this in the package is, first of all, creating a variable that is the maximum customer ID. Okay, so this execute SQL task is just executing a query that says, give me the max customer ID, return a single row, and then using the result set, this column will be mapped to this variable. And then in the data flow, after all of that deduplication logic, I have a script component down here. And under input columns, I specify that the customer ID, now that was the column that was added through the fuzzy lookup. That was a lookup. And so I've come in here and said, add it and allow it to be written to. And then in my script, I can use some custom logic to overwrite the values in there. So these will be for all the rows that I have determined and non-duplicates. So I'm opening up the Visual Studio Tools for Application window. And the logic goes like this. In the pre-execute method, so this happens when the data flow itself is about, about to execute, I have a variable out here that will store the customer ID. And so at the beginning of the entire data flow, I'm able to store in this integer variable the next customer ID, just the numeric portion. So the substring 2 is taking from the third character onwards. The parse method is parsing the string into an integer. That is now stored in this variable. And then for each row that passes through the transformation, we have this method here. I increment that variable by 1. And then to the customer ID column, I go ahead and assign this expression. AW plus the customer ID formatted to 8 places with leading zeros. So now I'm ready to go ahead and run this package. Let's discover what deduplication happens. So of the 10 rows that are being sourced from this Excel workbook, this is what we see. And I have a couple of data viewers that let us see the outputs of the fuzzy components. So far we see of the 10 rows, only 9 were output based on a lookup. One of the email addresses we already had in the customer table. Here with the sort, again, one was removed because it identified that there was a duplicate email address. And then another row was removed because there was a matching first name, last name, and birth date. So now we're down to 7. The fuzzy grouping assesses those 7. So see the first statistical column here? Each row gets a unique in key. But see here with the key out, it detected that this last one was actually the same with this type of match statistic. And the reason for that, if we look at Teresa here, is because we're matching on first name, last name, and address. Note the abbreviations here meant that it was close, but not close enough. So it doesn't end up being included in our result. So moving on, this is the data viewer for the next fuzzy component. This time the fuzzy lookup looking against the existing customers that we have. So of the 6 rows, the statistics of interest are right down the end. Overall, what is the similarity? And you can see that 3 of them are very, very close. Our threshold was 90%. So if anything is less than 90%, which are these two, then we don't have them in the source table. And then finally, they went into the script. The script component was able to generate the next 2 keys and the data. Only 2 out of 10 made it, were loaded into the table. So in fact, if I return to the original query here, we had 18,484, and now you can see we have 18,486. In fact, if I show you the last 5, these were the 2 that made it, and they have the correct keys. I want to show you also the script task. And I think a really relevant use of this is for custom logging. And we'll see why that becomes relevant later on when we deploy and execute the packages on the Sys catalog. So I have a package here that loads the fact sales table. Now, the whole project is driven by a project parameter, which is the ETL date. And this would allow us, it's in fact a required parameter, when executing any package within this project, we must pass in what date we're performing the ETL for. So what we see here is it will actually delete the existing fact rows for that particular date. And then I already have the data flow constructed here. And if interest is that I have a row count transformation that tells me the number of rows that have passed through. And I want this statistic to be logged so I can analyze it later on. So I return to the control flow and then I add a script task. On success, execute the script task and make that variable, the load row count, make it readable by the script. And then I produce some logic, again, in the Visual Studio Tools for Application window. I'm going to cheat a little bit. Here's the code I'm going to copy and paste in. So let me copy this to the clipboard. The main thing that I'm using is the fire information method of the events object. And there's actually a template available to you. So you can see here that there is help. There's fire error, there's fire information, there's fire warning. And I pretty much adapted that sample. So I come down to the main method and I paste it in. So let me move backwards. Fire information, that will be the message code. It's up to you to customize that value. There's the subcomponent. There's a description that you're having logged. That description is defined here in a variable. Insert count, and then from the variables collection, get the load row count, get its value, and convert it to a string. So that's the string that will become the description of the event. And then should it fire recursively? I have a variable here that says no, it shouldn't. So I like to go ahead and build that script. That just checks that it will build. And then we can go ahead and complete the configuration of the script task. So I execute the package. And what that will do then is log that event at execution time. And we can see that by switching across here to the progress. And there were no rows for today, but there we see information, insert count was 0. We'll come back to that later in another demonstration to see what we can do with it. That was implementing custom logics both with the script component in the data flow and the script task in your control flow. Number 4, CDC. What does CDC stand for? Sorry, too many people got it right at the same time. I had a thumb drive to give away. Okay, change data capture. It's a feature supported in the enterprise edition of SQL Server. It's a database engine feature. This is an efficient way of storing and therefore retrieving what changes happen on a table. The traditional and still a common way that when we populate dimension tables, what we're looking for in a source system is what is new and what is changed and possibly what is deleted in the source system. And we need to replicate those changes across to our dimension table. So the common way of doing this is to retrieve all source data and do some correlation with what you have in the dimension table and then do some checking. What is new, i.e. what don't we already have in the data warehouse, and what we do have, and there's significant changes or changes of interest, let's implement those changes into the dimension table. It's pretty much a synchronization from source into the dimension table. The fact is that that correlation can be extremely expensive and therefore slow when you have large sets of entities, like customers. So the change data capture is a really cool way to very efficiently store those changes and to query them through an API. Just give me the net changes that have happened on that table since I last used it. So this is a feature supported in both SQL Server Database Engine, and Oracle supports it as well. In SQL Server 2012 Integration Services, 3 additions were made to the toolbox. In the control flow, you have the CDC control task that allows you to manage the lifecycle of the package. Essentially, it stores the log sequence number, which allows you to know where we finished at the last execution, and you'll use that point to move forward incrementally with the next package execution, probably 24 hours later. In the data flow, you have the CDC source and the CDC splitter. The source allows you to retrieve from a CDC enable table, and the splitter is going to split out into 3 outputs: what's new, what's changed, what's deleted, and then it's up to you to do what you need to do with that. Let's see this in demonstration by seeing the older and less efficient approach. You may well be familiar with it. Here for my product table, the approach is used here to load the product dimension. Bring in everything from the data warehouse, bring in from the source, and do a merge join. You typically do a left outer, and what can't be matched is a new product. And what can be matched, we use a conditional split. Has this value in this column changed compared to this one? And so on and so on and so on and so on. And if it has, go ahead and perform some type of update to synchronize that change. Not efficient if I had tens of millions of products. So what I do then is I show you that I have no customers in my dimension table yet. This is important. I'll explain why. I am then going to enable CDC on the AdventureWorks source system. That's database-wide. And then at table level, you can enable CDC, and I'll do that on the sales customer table. And what it's doing then is creating all sorts of system tables. To actually store all of the CDC activity. In addition, and you need the SQL Server agent running, you're going to see that there are jobs that are keeping that CDC information up to date. Okay, the good news is it is efficient because at data modification time, see, the other approach is that you can use a trigger and actually push things to similar tables. But the problem is a trigger extends the lifetime of the transaction. It slows down what the source system is trying to do. Here, there's an agent, a log reader agent, that just looks at the transaction log and in a background process, not interfering with the performance of the inserts or modifications on the table, it's capturing and storing relevant information. So how can we exploit this within our package design? First of all, I have this package to initialize my dimension table. So I'm using the CDC control task. This involves the definition of a variable in the package that's going to store that log sequence number. And you can see here the operation is that we're initializing the load start. It's going to store the state of this in a table that I've created called the CDC states. And you may have multiple tables, therefore, you'll have one row per state that you have, or one row per table. The way that we identify that row is here. I've named it sales.customer. Next, I just use common data flow to take from source to destination. And then I wrap it up with another CDC control task, same configuration except that it's marking the load end. So basically what it's storing in this state table will be the log sequence number where it finished. So now I can execute this and that initializes my customer table. If we switch across, we can actually see in that CDC states table, that's the log sequence number where it finished off. Now what that means is for incremental loads now into that table, we have another package which would be to load the data warehouse. So I'm using a staging table, in fact I'm using two. So any updates or deletes, rather than doing row-based operations for each update and delete, we're going to stage them to separate tables. We then use the CDC control task, this time to get a processing range. The data flow task I'm about to configure, and this is how it gets configured. I retrieve the data from a CDC source. Where is it? Right down the bottom. And this is pretty straightforward. When I configure this against an ADO.NET data connection, the drop-down list will only give me the CDC-enabled tables. And there it is. Give me the net changes, not every change. If there were multiple updates that happened in the last 24 hours, just give me the net effect of that. And where is the CDC state being stored? It's in that variable. What columns are being returned? Well, all of the columns of the source table itself, in addition to these extra columns. They will be useful for the CDC splitter. So take the output from this source into the splitter, and then what we'll see is that there are just three outputs. The inserts, updates, and deletes that will come out, and it's just a matter of doing what's appropriate with those. So for the inserts, I need to use a derived column. This is just my custom logic. So I take the output that is the insert output. I configure a derived column that is the created date. And I'll just use the package parameter, which is the ETL date for it. And then I can just push them straight into the dimension table. And that's my dim customer, and we'll see that everything maps nicely across. For the updates, introduce another destination and take the update output. And for the same dimension table, well, in fact, not the dimension table, I'm using a staging table. And we'll see that all of the columns map across. Finally, for the deletes, yikes. That's really bizarre. That's why Control-Z or Z is going to be helpful. Bring in a third destination, and that's the last output, the delete output, and I'll push all of those changes to the delete stage table. The mapping is just concerned with mapping the customer ID, because we're just going to switch a flag that says this is now, it's not a hard delete, it's a logical delete of that customer. Back in the control flow then, I have a stored procedure that performs those batch updates. All updates will be done in one set-based operation. All deletes will update the rows and set that flag to inactive. And then finally, a CDC control task that is going to mark the process range complete. So before I execute this, I'll switch back to this script and we're going to go ahead and insert, update, and delete on this table. A new customer, a change to an existing customer, and the deletion of a row in the customer table in the source system. And then with much more efficiency now, the package will just retrieve the net changes and we'll just process them as I've just designed here. No rows. Can anyone tell me why? CDC hasn't fired yet. Yeah, so essentially it's a background process. Thank you. What's happened is that it could be some seconds before the log reader agent has done its job. All right, so if we execute this again now, it should work. That just reinforces the point that it doesn't happen synchronously with the modifications that I performed against the table. Am I correct? Yes, there we go. So all the rows have been passed through. We've updated the log sequence number in our states table, so the next time this package runs, it will start from that log sequence number and move forward. And now we have a total of 18,487 customers. That's change data capture and how you can easily produce packages on top of CDC-enabled tables. Number five, I have a question. Yes?
Those CDC tables, they're going to fill up pretty quickly, right?
The CDC tables will fill up pretty quickly. It depends what operations you're doing on there. Yes.
How do you put policies around? Because some really busy tables get chopped pretty big.
I'm not sure if you can do policies, but you can change the frequency of cleanup. So because you know this is a 24-hour ETL process, you don't need to really keep the history beyond 24 or 48 hours. So you can automate. Maybe you need to add some jobs in there that clean up the data that's in there, and you can. There's an API delivered in terms of stored procedures and user-defined functions that allow you to work with a CDC-enabled table. Okay, so that would be a question for another session. You could, in fact, dedicate a full session to how CDC works and how to maintain it. Number five, and you may well have seen this morning if you attended my session on data quality services and master data services. I won't assume that you were at that session. But new in SQL Server 2012 is a new service for cleansing data quality services. And correspondingly, in integration services, there's a new transform that allows us to leverage the knowledge base that we have on the service. So this implements data cleansing, but notably not deduplication in the data flow. The configuration I'll demonstrate. And what it does is output your original data together with corrected data, together with reason and status. And it's up to you in your design in the control flow to do something, or rather in the data flow, with a conditional split to assess the output. Do we log it? Do we accept the changes that have been implemented as part of the correction and so on? So I'll adapt the package that I have here. So I'm concerned that the email address, and I know you may have seen this in the earlier session, it's much the same. The email address may not be valid. We don't want invalid email addresses arriving, or if we do, we want to flag them so we can easily write reports and have people take action to update those email addresses. So I have a knowledge base already created here on data quality services, and the knowledge base consists of a single domain email address that uses a regular expression to determine what is an acceptable email address. So the way we can integrate this is, first of all, add a connection manager. So a great new feature in 2012 is project-level connection managers. We have a DQS type, and all it needs is the instance where it's hosted. I'd like to rename that to clean it up. So if I break this, yes, it will be used in external service. So it could be on a separate server. We could have data quality services installed there. Our knowledge base is being maintained there, and integration services can query across to it. And this is how it's done. So using the DQS cleansing transform, I will then take that output of the inserts. I will configure this transformation to use that connection manager just defined. We see that there's a knowledge base that consists of a single domain. Then in my mappings, and these are all of the input columns being passed into the transform, I'm concerned with the email address, and I map that to the email address domain. These are the three columns that will be output. What was the original data? What is the corrected data? And what is the status? Is it invalid? Is it corrected? Is it correct to begin with? I'm actually going to rename this just to email address so it uses the original input column as the output column. I'm interested in this status. So in my derived column, I create an expression that is email address valid. So I'm going to create a new column. And it's just based on this expression. I know it's a double negative, but email address status doesn't equal invalid. In other words, yes, it's valid. It will return true if it's a valid email address. Now, it's up to you what you do with this information. Do you log it to a separate table? What I'll do in this demonstration... Why is that not valid? Is email address valid? Did I? So I should have renamed this one email address. That one should be email address status. Thank you. So who said it's not connected? Thank you. I'm going to do an underarm to you. Close enough. So this component had no concept about what was being passed to it. I needed to connect it. So let's try that again. It's this expression. And it's is email address valid. All right. One last change is to come into the mappings to the destination. I already have this column in the source system. It defaulted to no, unless you tell me otherwise, and now I just map it across. So before I run the package again, I'm going to go ahead and insert two new customers. Notably, Jane has an invalid email address. Just at Hotmail isn't going to work. Nor is the attempt to insert them into the wrong database. All right, this one, invalid. Toby, not a problem. Let's go ahead and execute. There we go, two rows, and two rows passed down. Why does it look like, there we go. DQS has done its job, still two rows are passing through. And if we now query and look at the five last customers added, there's Jane. And we see that this email address is not valid. So it's now easy to run a report off this table and have someone action and update those. There's cleansing data with data quality services. Halfway through. Data mining is a favorite topic of mine. So the fact is that we could have mining models out there, and we can also integrate prediction queries and bring results back into the data flow. So the component notably includes a DMX query builder. The columns that you add here will be added to the output, and then you can do something with them. So potential could include cleansing of data through data mining logic and patterns and models that you have, filling in missing values. Better to have a predicted value than nothing in certain situations, or extending source data with predictions, which is my demonstration here. So a quick look at a model that's already been built. The customer mining uses the decision trees algorithm. And this model was built with the intention that we could analyze the probability that someone was going to buy from us or not. I mean, it's a pretty simple example. But it's very powerful when we want to categorize customers and allow marketing to focus their efforts on a subset rather than all customers. So the way that this would work, and I have a dedicated package for this, assigning a marketing class. So here I've got a partially built data flow that is retrieving all of the rows from the DIM customer table. And then what I do is I bring in the data mining query, take the output, pass it through. I need to connect to analysis services, so I build up a connection manager using integrated security to my customer mining database. There's a single mining structure. I can write my DMX in here, but you're going to find it's much more friendly and efficient to use the graphical query designer. So these are the columns being passed into the component. These are the columns or the attributes of the model, and there's an automatic mapping by name, so that's very, very convenient. So I'm going to introduce a single prediction function that will predict the probability and be named as confidence that they are a bike buyer. What's the probability that according to the demographics that they match being a bike buyer and to what degree? So this will form a new output column. And then I'm going to pass that straight to a destination. And conveniently, I've already built up a staging table for this. So we always like to work with set-based operations. Rather than update every row passing through, I'm passing everything to this staging table. And essentially, what it's storing is the customer key and that confidence that was just retrieved from the data mining query. So this is the logic. I have a stored procedure that I'm about to create here named this. So it will join the customer dimension table to that staging table. There are two columns in my customer dimension table. One is, what is that confidence, the bike buyer probability? And then to assist the marketing people, I have this logic here that will break them into the categories of low, medium, or high, according to the probability. So I go ahead and execute this to create the stored procedure and also run the query. That'll happen in a minute. And then I come back, complete the control flow by using an execute SQL task. So on success of the data flow, come down here using ADO.NET and my data warehouse connection manager. Go ahead and execute that stored procedure. So to integrate data mining results is reasonably straightforward. For all of those customers that I have, you can see it's fairly fast for analysis services to return that prediction result. And then we have the updates occur. And then just to take a look at the results here, we can see now that for all of my customers, I have a probability and a classification to a marketing class. Just out of interest, you can see this type of report can now be done. What sort of split do we have? About 7.5% are our high-value customers. And we'll send them the expensive brochure. For the medium, we might give them a phone call. For these, they're a lower priority. All right. Just think about the fact that that probability could have helped to assess cleanliness of your data as well. And you could have then used that to help determine whether this needs to be logged, whether it requires human attention to go ahead and validate the data that you're accepting into your data warehouse. Number 6, integrating data mining predictions. Number 7, working with environments. So at this point within my demonstration, I need to start working with deployment. I need to deploy this project to the SIS catalog on the server to start showing you the other features that we have. So environments allow you to execute packages by using different values being passed into parameters and connection managers. It's probably best shown through demonstration. So I already have an integration services catalog. What it requires me to do then is to deploy my project to the server. And this is what's great in 2012, is that the entire project, consisting of parameters, connection managers, and packages, get deployed as a single unit to my Apollo server. On that server, I have a folder named AdventureWorks BI, and then it deploys the whole lot in one go. So, what we then see is the catalog is down here. And within the catalog, it's broken down by folder. And within folders are the projects that you've deployed. And within the projects, you have your packages. They're all there. There are environments as well. So I know that I want to test my packages before I put them into production, so I create a test environment. And when it goes to production, I also want to execute within the production environment. Environments then each have a collection of environment variables. Don't confuse them with the environment variables on the operating system. So I create a variable here that will be the product photo folder path of type string. And if I'm running this in test, on the test server, it's going to use this folder here. If I'm going to run it on the production environment, I'm going to have a variable of the same name, so I copy that in, same type, but it's going to use the Apollo server and a share that's named product photos. So creating environments isn't enough. You need to go in and configure a project to reference those environments. So I configure my project under references here. I add in each of those. And then under parameters, I can come down to a project like the dim product export photo. And it shows me that I've got that parameter, which is the folder path. And I can tell it, well, it could use the value that was developed in the package, or it could use the environment variable that is my product photo folder path. And now with that binding in place, when I go to execute the package, so be aware there's an ETL date, because that was a project parameter, then every package will have it. So I need to satisfy it with the required value. And then for the folder path, note that when I select an environment here like production, it knows that it will take the value from that environment variable. And then I can just execute. And the default behavior when you execute here in Management Studio is that it will open up a built-in report. And so we'll see in the report here that summarizes the execution that it shows over here the parameter values that were passed in. And sure enough, it was the Apollo share that was used in that execution. So that's the concept of an environment. Think beyond just dev, test, and production. It could be that you've got different classifications of customers and you want to reuse the same package design, but for different classifications you might pass in different values. So it can be adapted to other types of solutions. That's working with environments. Next. So the question is, can we export those environments back to the file system? No. They belong inside the sys catalog. You can script them. All right? And that's really the topic here. What's really cool about the sys catalog is that it has a public API that is in the form of views, stored procedures, and functions. Anything that belongs to the catalog schema, you're welcome to help yourself to. So in fact, all of the UI that you have in Management Studio for configuring projects, creating environments, executing packages, you can script as T-SQL. They're just stored procedures. All right, so you can automate what happens inside this environment. In addition, the views will surface all sorts of interesting data about what you've cataloged and the events that have been logged during package execution. We'll see how this comes to play in a moment. So it's just a SQL Server user database, And like I've said, help yourself to the catalog schema and the resources that are available there. So the demonstration that I have for you here is that I need to execute the fact sales package not just once, but for every day of the first quarter of 2012. So I come into the UI to execute this package, and we see the required parameter. So I'm going to set that for the first day of the period, the 1st of January 2012. And there's the temptation to click OK and just execute it. But up here, I have the ability to script this to a query editor window. So here's the T-SQL that would implement that for me. All right, I'm going to clean things up just a little. So I'm going to move the variable declarations right to the top. I'm going to remove the select statement here that is simply returning the unique execution ID for that package. Don't need it. And what we see then are four stored procedures that are executed. One is create the execution itself. So what is the package? What is the unique identifier? That'll be returned as an output parameter. Where is that package located? In this project, in this folder. Next, there are two parameters that need to be set with the execution parameter value. There's the ETL date that will be passed in based on the value in variable zero. The logging level, this is an automatic concept in the syscatalog. There's a server-wide property that lets you determine what is the logging level, and it can be overwritten at execution time. It is passed in as if it were a parameter. So that's the second parameter. And then finally, there's a stored procedure here that will execute that execution ID. So just clean this up a little. That's my first date. I can then come in here and just use standard T-SQL. While that variable is less than the 1st of April, then execute those four stored procedures. Increment that variable with each loop. And I was so close. There we go. It's executing the package 91 times for me. That's just one example of what you can do with T-SQL. It could be that looking up these values might come from some other control table to populate the parameters that get executed. All right, all done with T-SQL. We'll come back to this one. That's working with the syscatalog API. Next, and a new feature in 2012, and only supported in the syscatalog, is the ability to run a data tap. So you know at design time, when you're working in data flow, that you can add data viewers. Inside Visual Studio, it allows you to look at the data that's flowing through. What happens when you've deployed it is that those data viewers are basically, they don't happen server-side when you execute a package. Yet if there is the requirement to have a look at the data that is flowing through a path within your data flow, without the modification of the package itself, you can at execution time add a data tap and have the output of the data flow sent to a CSV file. And this is how it works. So there is a stored procedure that will do this. I'm just going to adapt this script by removing the looping logic. And I'll execute the package for the 1st of January is still good. So before I execute it, I'm going to pass in something here. And what I'm passing in is the execution of this stored procedure, which is add a data tap. So I'm mindful that this script is still executing. So what I need to complete is this. It knows the package we're executing because that's set here in the create execution stored procedure. Within the package, it wants to know what is the path to the data flow because, of course, there could be multiple data flow tasks in the single package. So the easy way to look that up is to go to the package design, and yes, you do need to know this in order to add a data tap. And you'll find that there is a property of the task itself, which is the package path. That's the path within the package to get to that control flow task. So I copy that and paste that into that parameter. And then within the data flow, because you could have multiple components, which output are you adding the data tab to? So in this demonstration, I will do it to this output here. So the selection of that path, there's a property here called the identification string. And I copy it, and I pass that in. And then finally, what will be the name of the file? My sales output data. And then I execute. So it executes the package as normal. Where that file ends up is where you've installed SQL Server. So for me, it's in program files under SQL Server, under the current version, and then under DTS, we have a data dumps folder. And that's where that CSV has ended up. And then you do something with it. So no need now to consider that looking at data is a design time concept or development time. You now have this ability to connect the data tap at execution time.
Is that only when you run it manually?
Is that only when you run it manually? Yes, you do need to do it the way that I demonstrated. Okay, that was number 9, the data tap. The timing is good. I think I have 5 more minutes to get through number 10. And because I'm an analytic person and I love working with analysis services, I couldn't help but overlook the fact that we have this wealth of data that is being accumulated in the catalog in the form of events that are firing off when packages are being executed. So SysCatalog views can surface a wealth of information that can help produce analytic and reporting solutions. Consider using PowerPivot to produce a data model to interactively analyze and monitor the data that's being accumulated in your catalog. You can create reports then off the PowerPivot model by using pivot tables and pivot charts, Report Builder if you publish this workbook to SharePoint, and then PowerView is another option you've got then to interactively work with the data that you have. You can also extend the built-in reports that the SysCatalog has itself. So I think I'll have time to demonstrate both of them for you here. Here's a query that joins 3 of the SysCatalog views together. The executions that have happened, the parameter values that were passed in at execution time, and the event messages that were actually raised and stored. So I join all of them together, and then I filter by a particular package name, which is my fact sales. I'm interested in the parameter ETL date, and I'm interested in events that have that code 999999. Do you recall in my script task? I then logged the number of rows that were actually processed. I'm also filtering where the parameter value is within the current year. So a couple of things to point out here is that I am prefixing the views with the name of the database, and I am using the current year, and let me explain why in a moment. So I copy these, and I switch across to Report Builder, and against a connection to the SysDB, that's the SysCatalog, I go ahead and create a data set. And I paste that query in, and that gives me the 2 fields of the date and the rows loaded for that date. And then it's a simple matter of just inserting some visualization like a chart. Based on that data source, on data set, I'm going to introduce a line chart where the date is the category and the rows loaded is my values. I'll use the generic style and finish. So a quick cleanup, I'm just going to remove the title, the legend, I'm going to hide the axis titles, and I'll format the axis properties. So what I get to see is the date in a friendly way. And I'll choose this one here, just the month followed by the month day number. Let's make it big enough. And I could run this for you straight away, but I'm just going to go ahead and save it. Save it down, not to the report server, but to the file system, sitting in my D demo folder. And what you can do is extend the built-in reports, and that's a whole nother topic, no time to talk about, but I can customize by adding in my own reports. And then I can run them here within Management Studio. All right, they're accessible now by right-clicking reports, show me fact sales rows loaded by day. So the two things I pointed out to you was that I had to prefix sysdb in front of the views because it's going to connect using my identity, and it depends what my default database is. We can't assume it's going to be sysdb. That's why sysdb was in the from clause. And the where clause, it said, give me the current year. I can't use parameters in this style. These are built-in reports using the report viewer control. All right. So you don't need reporting services installed for this, by the way. It's local reporting, but it doesn't support parameterization in the way that server-based reports do. Good question, where is it? I still don't have an answer for that. I can't find it on the file system. And I've never tested this. So the question was, where is that report definition stored? I can't see it in the sysdb. I hoped it would be there. Therefore, anybody right-clicking on this should get to it. If someone knows, could they let me know? It won't use it. So if I delete it from the operating system, I'm pretty sure it won't. So if I come down to my demo folder, and I delete it from here, and then we close this, and then we rerun it. Oh no, it has gone. I'm pretty sure I tested this in CTP3 and it was still working, but maybe I got it wrong. So there you go. It is based on the local reports that I have. Thank you. Can I give you a prize for that? Or an exam certificate? All right, come see me at the end. I have one for you. All right, I have got negative 1 minute to show you one more thing. So the PowerPivot workbook here. So creating tables in PowerPivot, like my execution, is just based off this whopping query that queries the views within the sysdb database. It's very, very easy to work out what this information means, so I don't have time to go through that now, but if I've published that to SharePoint and I open up PowerView, then I can do something like this. Let's build a report that allows me to analyze the rows loaded by day because I have that event that's firing off the rows that are being inserted. So I go ahead and I create a slicer that supports interactivity. I know that's a little hard to see, but I'm filtering by the year 2012. I then bring in another slicer for month, and I create a slicer on it, and I'll filter on January. We'll move that to the side. And then I've also got the packages table. So there's all the packages that are being cataloged, and I create a slicer for it as well. I'm going to put this in full screen mode in a minute. You'll get to see the completed design. So there's some interactivity to filter by year, month, and package. And then I'll introduce a report by day, and I have these measures that will tell me execution times and rows loaded. And I will create a column chart for it. So now switching across to full screen mode, hopefully you can see that a little better, is that we can come in then and analyze what happened on certain days, how many rows were loaded, what happened in February, what happened in March. And this really emphasizes the point that the resources that you have available to you in the Sys catalog are just like any other data store. In fact, you might use integration services to perform ETL from its catalog. That's sort of bizarre when you think about it, all right? But it might well be worth analyzing. So that arrives me at the end of the top 10, according to me anyway, extraordinary things that you can achieve with SQL Server 2012 integration services. There were 10 demonstrations. In summary, we see a rich set of features, capabilities, delivered around a robust, flexible, fast, scalable, and extensible architecture that is integration services now in its fourth release. While it's primarily designed for ETL processes, it's useful in many other scenarios, and I've hoped to inspire you with what you can achieve with the product. From a related point of view, here at this conference, there were some sessions that covered integration services as far as EIM, and there is an exam that maps to this. Other resources are available at the standard locations. We very much appreciate your feedback, so your evaluations are very, very useful for us, especially because this is the first time that I presented this topic. I would love to hear from you if you think that something is missing, if something deserved more attention, or just what your favorite feature was that might just need more emphasis. Please let me know. Otherwise, thank you very much for your time and attendance.